For God's sake, take cover.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the 1966 Topeka tornado. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPER Presents, we'll look back at June 8, 1966, and the tornado that killed 16 people and injured hundreds. The F5 tornado caused $100 million in property damage. In today's dollars, that would be about $740 million, making the Topeka tornado one of the most destructive in Kansas history. Later this hour, we'll hear from veteran broadcaster Bill Curtis, who was on the air for 24 hours straight at Topeka television station WIBW during and after the tornado. His dire warning, "For God's sake, take cover," is widely credited with saving the lives of many Topekans as the tornado passed through the city. But first, Bonner Menninger, author of And Hell Followed With It, a gripping account of the 1966 Topeka tornado. Up until June 8, 1966, many Topekans believed their city was impervious to tornadoes. Why was that?
There was an Indian legend that claimed or suggested that a hill on the southwest edge of the city would protect the town from tornadoes. Burnett's Mound is the name of the hill, and the legend was that when the Potawatomi Indians were moved to Kansas as part of the Indian Removal Act of 1830, a tornado hit their village, killed many of the Indians, and they were buried on this hill, and supposedly the Great Spirit agreed to protect the region from tornadoes in the future as long as these graves were not disturbed. However, in 1960, the city built a 5-million-gallon water storage tank on the site of Burnett's Mound, and that caused some to worry a bit. As it happened, the tornado in 66 came right over the top of the mound, and in fact right over that water tank. So you can call that coincidence or karma, I don't know.
Back in the 1960s, it was still the very early days of tornado forecasting. And in fact, in your book, And Hell Followed With It, you say that meteorologists really didn't want to alert people about tornadoes. Tell us about sort of the culture of meteorology at the time.
Yeah, it was something I had no idea about until I got into this. But in the 1880s, there was an individual in the U.S. Signal Corps named John Park Finley, who had done a lot of research about tornadoes, studied their damage, gone out and visited a number of tornado events. In fact, his way to rate the damage was very much like the Fujita scale, which would come, you know, almost 100 years later. But Finley did this work and was supported for a time, but at some point a decision was made to basically pull the rug out from under him. He started to do preliminary tornado forecasts, and the powers that be in the National Weather Bureau, which was actually part of the U.S. Army Signal Corps at that time, decided that this was information that the public probably didn't need. Their reasoning was that, you know, tornado watches and warnings would basically cause panic, that they would disrupt commerce, and because it was so difficult to do, the Signal Corps would look poorly if they were wrong. So they instituted a ban on the word tornado and tornado forecasting. And unfortunately, that lasted for close to 60 years. And it was only in 1952 that the now independent National Weather Bureau began to forecast tornadoes, and only after a great deal of pressure from the public and politicians.
So, keeping all that in mind, tell us about the role that Richard Garrett played in the Topeka tornado.
Yeah, he was the meteorologist in charge of the Topeka office of the National Weather Bureau, and he came to Topeka in 1949. He was a native Kansan. He was a veteran with the Weather Bureau. He'd been in a lot of different cities, a lot of different climates. But when he got here, soon after, the ban was lifted on tornado forecasting, and Garrett set to work making Topeka's tornado preparedness as sophisticated as he could, and he used a number of tools or techniques to do that. He established volunteer spotter networks that would go out and watch for the tornadoes. He established communications between the National Weather Bureau and the law enforcement and media. And he developed public awareness, probably the most important thing he did, about what to do when a tornado was coming. He also essentially commandeered the civil defense sirens. There were 19 of them in Topeka. Forbes Air Force Base was a SAC base, nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles out in the countryside around Topeka. So it was a target. So there were these 19 sirens, and he essentially said, you know, the chances of getting a tornado are a lot stronger than a Russian missile attack, so we're going to use these for tornado warnings. So he did a whole range of different things in a lot of different areas to prepare the city, almost as if, well, he was preparing it for a worst-case scenario, and unfortunately, that transpired on June 8th, 1966.
Bonner, take us back to that date and how the events of the day unfolded.
It started as a cool and rainy day, foggy, and there was a big low-pressure system moving out of southwest Kansas, Dodge City, around 4 o'clock that day. And in fact, they'd issued a tornado watch about 2 in the morning because they saw this low moving towards the city, and there was also a warm front coming north, kind of straight up from Oklahoma, and they knew if those two air masses collided, it was likely there would be severe weather. The day was kind of overcast and drizzly and kind of very un-tornado-like, really, until 4 o'clock, the overcast burned off. It got very hot and very humid, and the storms began to develop west of Topeka soon after that. The spotters, of course, deployed, as was part of the program in Topeka, several to Burnett's Mound, and shortly before 7 o'clock, the funnel dropped out of the clouds south of Dover, Kansas, about 15 miles southwest of Topeka. Interestingly, it was blue sky behind it. It was clear, so it was on the backside of this supercell that had come through. It rained torrentially, you know, ahead of the tornado, and then the rain died off, and the funnel dropped, and it was spotted and reported to the National Weather Bureau office via CB-equipped spotters. Police officer Dave Hathaway was up there, too. They called it in, and it was moving towards Burnett's Mound. And the sirens went off, I think, at 7:02 p.m. The tornado came over Burnett's Mound about 7:14. So there was, 10 minutes or so, a little bit more than that before it hit the southwest edge of the city.
One of the people that was on Burnett's Mound at the time was Rick Douglas of mm-hmm. radio station WREN. Tell us about Rick.
Well, he was a disc jockey well known in Topeka. He was 19 years old. He was at REN. They took their severe weather spotting responsibilities very seriously, alerting the public, and he was driving the Wrenmobile, which was kind of their little storm chaser unit. And he was sent to Burnett's Mound to keep an eye on this storm as it was coming in. This is before the tornado had been spotted. So he made the drive up the winding road to the top of Burnett's Mound, and by that point, the other spotters that had initially identified the tornado, John Meinholt and Dave Hathaway, had left the area. So Douglas got to the top. He said it was like this brown mist. He couldn't really see anything, and then he saw a fence go flying by, and one of his colleagues who was down in the valley to the west said, "Rick, you got to get out of there. You know, this tornado's coming right at you." So he swung around, and he realized what he was looking at was this half-mile-wide funnel on the ground. And so he headed down Burnett's Mound at a high rate of speed, grabbed the mic, and started broadcasting live and just said, this thing's huge. It's coming into the southwest part of the city. If you're anywhere out around here, you need to take cover right now. And got down to the underpass at 470 Engage, bailed out, tried to get up under the bridge, which is where Officer Hathaway and several others had taken refuge, lost his balance, and was grabbed by the tornado, but because by now it had come up over the mound and was moving across 470, and it carried him about a 100 yards before it dropped him. And he said that when he finally stopped moving, he looked up and saw a 59 Pontiac Bonneville with its doors flapping like the wings of a gull, just slowly drifting on the backside of the tornado headed east. But I can imagine that was quite a sight.
Another broadcaster associated for all time with the 1966 mm-hmm. tornado is, of course, Bill Curtis. And we'll hear from Bill Curtis later on this hour. But tell us about the role he played as the events transpired.
Curtis was at WIBW, the only TV station in Topeka, and had received word that the tornado was coming and had passed that on to people. He was now in front of the camera. He'd always told his wife, you know, if this is really serious, I'm going to give you a call, so don't worry. But the problem was now he was stuck in front of the camera. After it came over Burnett's Mound, he was handed a note that said the tornado just destroyed the embassy apartments, and he said he could kind of, in his mind, gauge the trajectory and realize it was headed towards Washburn and towards where his wife and daughter were. And so he said he just kind of freaked. He didn't know what to do or say that would convey the gravity and danger of the moment. And so he said he almost started crying, but then he just rallied and just said, you know, for God's sake, take cover. And that maybe doesn't seem like that big a deal now, but at the time it was very much a departure from what and how broadcasters typically spoke to the public. And I think that personal nature of it, he crossed a threshold, and certainly, like, you know, it's like he was grabbing people through the TV and saying, you know, this is real. You got to get to safety. And it definitely got a lot of people's attention. Although something that he did subsequent to that that's not really been reported is that he basically gave a running play-by-play as the tornado moved deeper into the city. And a number of people I talked to said that, you know, that was the key information that they needed when they heard that, for example, the tornado was at Washburn, or that it was approaching downtown, or that it was moving through Oakland. They acted on that. So he played a role, a very important role, in saving a lot of lives that day. But, you know, it was a combined effort. He wouldn't have had those reports if it weren't for the courage of the people, law enforcement and citizens that were out there phoning this information into WIBW in real time, basically, so that he could in turn convey it to the public.
If you walk through the campus of Washburn University today, you would never guess that it had been the scene of so much destruction in the 1966 tornado. Bonner, talk about the effect that the tornado had on the Washburn campus.
You know, if you walk through there on the evening of June 8th, you would probably think that there was no way this institution would ever survive, because it was basically destroyed. The vast majority of the buildings were wrecked. All the beautiful old stone buildings were blown up. It was a mess. I mean, it destroyed hundreds of trees on campus. And I think there was a lot of people that thought, you know, Washburn's done. But not the people that ran it, fortunately. And it was very fortuitous that in the spring of 1966, the board of Washburn, Board of Trustees, I guess, had made the decision to change the way the building was insured, and they essentially bought a replacement policy as opposed to the prorated or amortized value of the buildings, the construction cost. So what that allowed them to do was go out and build a brand new campus, and that's exactly what they did. They brought in trailers to get back up and running by the fall. But over the course of, next 20 years, there was a building boom there, and they gradually replaced all that had been lost with buildings that were certainly newer, you know, maybe not quite the character that those old stone buildings had, but the institution survived and continues to thrive today, and that's pretty amazing when you look at those photos. And something else about Washburn, I think there was at least 300 people on campus that night, and and the number of serious injuries were, you know, less than 20, and no one was killed. And that in and of itself is amazing. You know, that's really the fundamental takeaway from the Topeka tornado, that you had an F5 go 8 miles through a city, and yet only 16 people lost their lives. And that, as far as I can determine, and certainly it's the opinion of others, that that's a tribute directly to the work that Richard Garrett had done in preparing the city, not only its warnings, but the population, so that they knew what to do when danger threatened, and they did it.
Well, and part of it is just dumb luck in a way.
Mm-hmm.
The as I understand it, the Washburn's commencement had originally been scheduled for
June 8th. Yeah. Yeah, it was earlier in the spring, I think, or maybe at the end of the spring semester, early spring semester, they had initially penciled it in for the evening of June 8th, and it would have been in Moore Bowl, the football stadium, which was, the tornado went right over it. But God only knows how it would have turned out if there was, you know, 10,000 people in that football stadium.
One thing that was going on the Washburn campus the night of June 8th was a music recital.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
There was 40 people there, like 20 students or 15 students and parents and grandparents and relatives. It was a music teacher and his wife that had been giving lessons. They gathered and started about 7 o'clock. Had just gotten underway in McVicker Chapel, which was the music building. And they just began, the sirens went off, and Mr. Snyder, I believe his name was, said, you know, the sirens are going off, we need to go downstairs, and maybe we can continue down there. So they did. They went down, and he initially went to the southwest corner of the building, because he wanted to keep the recital going, the performers were accompanied by piano, he whipped out a little riff on the piano and realized that it was badly out of tune. So he said, well, this won't work. We got to go to somewhere else. So they went to another room, and that piano, too, was out of tune. They finally went to his practice studio, and fortunately, the piano worked there, so they brought chairs in. So they were in that room not 10 minutes later when the tornado made a direct hit on McVicker Chapel. And it was chaos, and it was scary, and a number of people were hurt, none seriously. But really the miracle of that event was that the room that they'd initially gone to and the room that they were supposed to go to by virtue of, tornado safety doctrine in the southwest corner was buried. The second floor had collapsed, and there was tons of rock, stone, timbers. So there's a good chance that some, if not all of those people, would have been killed, but for that, quirk, the fact that that piano was out of tune. Otherwise, they would have been in that room.
I'm visiting with Bonner Menninger. He's the author of And Hell Followed With It, an account of the 1966 Topeka tornado. Bonner, when you started working on this book 40 years after the tornado had gone through Topeka, were you surprised by how much detail people remembered about that evening?
Yeah, you know, for a lot of them, it was just like yesterday. You experience a traumatic event, and I think there's, one or two ways you can deal with it. You can remember every excruciating detail, or you can basically blank it out. And sometimes it's a little bit of both. And people were, they remembered the smells and the sounds and the conversations. So I've had people say, well, man, how did you make this seem so alive, even though it was so long ago? And the answer is, it was the people that were telling me the stories. You know, I just recorded their stories and wrote them up. And some things exist outside of time. Memories, emotions, they don't know a statute of limitations. And so when people began to think again about what they'd gone through, all of a sudden it became very vivid, and they're conveying things to me that perhaps they hadn't talked about in a long, long time. And so fortunately, my tape recorder was going, and I just tried to get all that detail down and then get it in a way that was accurate in terms of their experience.
You talked to literally dozens of survivors of the Topeka tornado in writing this book. Are there one or two people that really stood out in your mind?
They all do. I mean, I don't know what I expected when I started in terms of what the impact of this would be on me, but I quickly realized that this is heavy. This is not some great adventure. This was life and death, and even though it was 40 years ago, for these people, it was, like I say, just as real as yesterday. So I don't know if it was because I tape recorded those interviews and then transcribed those interviews and then went back through the transcriptions and then wrote it up and then revised it and polished it. But it feels like just at some level, I kind of went through all these experiences with these people. I had to basically channel what happened to them to get it down on paper. So the result is I think of these experiences a lot, even now, you know, even though it's been 3-4 years since I interviewed the people and a year or so since I finished the book. But, you know, they're just so scary. A little girl that her mom was pacing the house and looking out the window and they're watching TV. And finally her mom runs into the bathroom and gets her dad and he runs out and grabs his glasses and looks out the window and says, "Come on, girls," and lifts up the bed and sticks them under the bed. And she said that she heard the roar and then the sunlight, of course, that was still, it was shining after the thunderstorm had passed, but before the tornado started to get in front of the sun and it just went dark as this roar, this enormous roar drew closer. And then the next thing you know, the house just blew up and she's lying in the mud by the slab. But she told me, and her mother told me, that something that she'd never known when her dad was alive, that as it was happening, the wind picked her up. She was just 8 years old, and the wind was taking her, and her dad reached up and grabbed her and just held her against the wind and managed to save her. But, you know, that's pretty intense, and a couple of guys watched it from the 10th floor of the Santa Fe office building, come across the mound, move straight forward towards them. They could mark its progress by the transformers blowing. But I've been up there, up at that level in the downtown buildings, and tried to envision what it was like to watch that thing kind of snake towards them. And it went straight at them. And in fact, it got to that building and sucked the windows out. And the power went out, all the papers go flying, and they ran for their lives. And he said he turned to look, and he saw this, you know, 100-year-old cottonwood tree right by the window, horizontal. This is the 10th floor, 10 stories up Jackson Street, and there's this giant tree just kind of hovering right by the window, and then it slowly drifts north. But just some of the things that people saw and felt, you know, and the emotions that they experienced, it's heavy.
Speaking of the emotions that one would feel when you see a tornado coming your direction, I wish I'd kept track of the number of times I read the word mesmerized. People were mesmerized by the sight of the approaching tornado. Bonner, can I have you read an excerpt from your book? It's the story of Patricia Galbraith.
Okay. Several miles to the southeast, 26-year-old Patricia Galbraith stood on high ground in her front yard and watched the tornado chew through the city. The funnel was wide and black and brilliantly backlit by the slanting rays of the dying afternoon sun. Pieces of metal and glass suspended in the twister caught the light, and the shards glittered like 1,000 diamonds against the swirling dark band. Never had Galbraith beheld a more breathtaking sight. "It looks like an angry god," she thought. "For God's sake, Pat, you've got to come inside." It was her husband, Jim. He stood near the house, gesturing wildly with one arm, holding their one-year-old daughter in the other, frantic with worry. The couple's three other children already were in the basement. But Pat did not come. She could not. She was mesmerized by the tornado's terrible majesty. It was as if the funnel was casting a spell that hypnotized all who dared look upon it. Fortunately, the twister continued on a path perpendicular to Galbraith, and the danger subsided. Quote, "There was something extremely seductive about it," Galbraith said 40 years later. If the tornado would have called my name, I would have gone to it.
That just sends chills down my spine.
Yeah, that's probably the best quote in the book. I mean, but you know, you see some of this video and you can understand, because you just don't see that every day, and you just don't see that. They're very graceful and they're very powerful and they're very fluid, you know, and they even tell you in spotter school, don't get transfixed. And if it looks like it's not moving but getting bigger, that means it's coming straight at you and you need to get out of there. But I might have been the same way. You don't see an F5 every day, and you probably want to try and capture that in your mind as long as you can, but not the brightest thing to do. And again, it's natural, and I probably would do it myself, but you need to get out of there before it gets too close, because it's so hard to judge the distance and the speed, and then boom, all of a sudden it's on you and it's too late. And there's no telling how many of these fatalities were the result of that, because, you know, it looked big, but, you know, well, how far away is it? And boom, too late.
I've got to ask you about the title of the book and how followed with it.
Yeah, I wanted to steal the title of the famous photo insert that the Capital Journal did later in 66, The Day the Sky Fell, because I always thought that nailed it. But then I thought, you know, that's kind of weak to not come up with something on my own. And I was down at the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, and they have, you know, the part that everybody's familiar with, the tower. But then there's also on the north side this huge, I don't know, it's a frieze, but it's like a sculpture against the wall. And I saw that quote from the book of Revelations, I guess chapter 6, verse 8. And I looked, and behold, the pale horse, and the name that sat on him was death, and hell followed with him. And I thought, well, that's pretty spooky, and that kind of captures the motion, and it was white. It was pale coming across towards Burnett's Mound, so I thought that'll work.
That's Bonner Menninger, author of And Hell Followed With It, a gripping account of the 1966 Topeka tornado. Bonner Menninger will be in Topeka this Wednesday, June 8th, to recall the events of 50 years ago. He's giving a talk sponsored by the Topeka Chamber of Commerce, which will be held at the offices of the Topeka Capital Journal. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Coming up, broadcaster Bill Curtis remembers the events of June 8, 1966, but first, an account of the Topeka tornado from a good friend of mine. Kathy Tilden was 7 years old, living just north of Washburn University in 1966. That evening, she was home with her brothers, her cousins, and her aunt when the tornado hit.
One of my cousins had run upstairs to close the windows because it was starting to rain, and I remember the windows just breaking as she was closing the windows. So she ran down, and we all went into the basement. We were sitting on the stairs of the basement, kind of huddled together in a group, my aunt and all the children. And I remember I was at an angle where I could actually see up the stairs, and I remember seeing the door open, shut, and then I remember seeing the refrigerator going across the room. And at the time, we were all praying.
And then
daylight. We were just in this stairwell, and we looked up, and there was just daylight. Because at that point, then the roof was taken off and the walls, and it was just sky. Water was coming down into the basement because so many pipes get broken in a tornado, that we needed to get out of the basement. So we came upstairs. We're walking through the house as carefully as possible because all the children were barefoot. And we walked past a glass partition on the wall. And I remember it just shattering at that time, and all of us just being very, very emotional and terrified at that moment. Like, we really realized what had happened. And then going out onto the front porch, and we were just on the front porch just a very short time looking at hot wires that were down, broken items, you know, cars turned over, houses gone. And the National Guard in the area were there, and they immediately helped us cross those hot wires and those danger zones and put us into an area that they thought at that time was safe, and went on to round up other people. But then they realized that that area wasn't safe, and so they moved us over to another area because there was a gas station of some kind that was on fire, and they thought it was going to explode. So at that moment, I don't know if you could call it a miracle or somebody just a generous human being. A very nice elderly couple stopped and asked us if they could help us. And they took my aunt and all of my cousins and my brothers and escorted us to their own private home, fed us, gave us snacks, and went into the channels to try to communicate with people. Back then, there were only landlines, so it was difficult because so many of the power lines and telephone lines were down. But they were wonderful people, and I wish I knew their name now, because I would love to still, even 50 years later, just be able to look at them and just say, thank you so much. You know, what you did was a wonderful thing that helped a lot of children that were really terrified that night.
Kathy Tilden lives in Lawrence. If you survived the 1966 Topeka tornado, we'd love to hear your story. You can share it with us on KPR's Facebook page. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Today on KPR Presents, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the Topeka tornado. On June 8, 1966, an F5 tornado, half a mile wide, ripped through the heart of Topeka. By the time it left the ground 26 minutes and 20 miles later, it had claimed the lives of 16 people, injured hundreds, destroyed 800 homes, and damaged thousands more. With property damage of more than $100 million, the 1966 tornado was one of the costliest on record at the time. Although it's overshadowed by the Topeka tornado, an F3 tornado hit Manhattan, Kansas that same day. According to the National Weather Service, the Manhattan tornado had a 19-mile-long path starting near Fort Riley and moving across the northern part of Manhattan. It caused 65 injuries, destroyed 11 homes, damaged 300 more, and caused almost $2 million of damage at Kansas State University. Also, that same night, two tornadoes were reported in Leavenworth County, causing one fatality and two injuries near Jarbalo. The second of those two tornadoes was an F4 on the ground for 19 miles. Tornadoes were also reported that day in Clay and Rice counties. In fact, there were more than 50 tornadoes reported over an 11-day period starting June 3, 1966. Tornadoes were spotted in Oklahoma, Texas, Nebraska, Iowa, Kentucky, Florida, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and South Dakota. The Topeka tornado was by far the most devastating of those. One man who has been inextricably linked to the 1966 Topeka tornado is veteran broadcaster Bill Curtis. Curtis has hosted and produced many news and crime documentaries. He anchored CBS Morning News for several years and has won numerous awards and honors, including 20 Emmy Awards. He can be heard every Saturday on NPR's quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Curtis currently serves on the Kansas Public Radio Advisory Board. In fact, his relationship with KPR dates back to the early 1960s when he attended the University of Kansas. Curtis worked as a student announcer at KANU, the flagship station of Kansas Public Radio. But by 1966, Curtis was attending Washburn University Law School and working part-time at Topeka television station WIBW. His broadcast the night of June 8, 1966, was widely credited for saving many lives. Bill Curtis joins us by telephone from his office in Chicago.
I was all set to become a lawyer. You go to 3 years and you say, well, I'm going to turn that preparation, into practice. But on the other side, it was a very difficult decision for me because I had also had, by that time, 10 years experience in broadcasting. But broadcasting then, it's hard to believe, was in the nascent period of television news. Walter Cronkite, in 1962, had just begun a half-hour show, the one we see today. The civil rights movement was being covered by television, first time, a giant, movement like that had been picked up by television, and essentially we tapped into the conscience of the nation. And then it was sliding into Vietnam. In Vietnam, 1966, Chu Lai was the first landing of U.S. Marines there, so it was clear that television news was just getting on its feet. I, however, didn't think that it was yet there with the kind of seriousness that I wanted, and so I decided I'm going to practice law. That evening, I left my tax review class because I told the news director, Tom Parmley, for WIBW that I would fill in for him so he could leave for vacation early. And I had, over the 2 or 3 years there, had switched from 2 years of being the weatherman into news and being an anchor man and learning how to shoot and go out. I arrived to do the 6 o'clock news and did it. At 6:30, why we received a weather report that there was a front coming through Manhattan and it had blown the roofs off some garages and buildings. As we would later find out, it was much more serious than that. But that's the report that we got. And so we went into tornado watch mode. We didn't have the Doppler radar, all the fancy gadgets that they do today, so we would literally send spotters out to watch the horizon, sort of like the Luftwaffe coming in to London. And everybody was on station. We took it very seriously. So we said, I want to get back to my tax review class, but I'll stick around. And why don't we go back on at 7 o'clock? People didn't like us interrupting their programs. WIBW was Channel 13 in Topeka, 60 miles from Kansas City. And although we did get some shows from Kansas City, it was an era largely before cable. Cable was for the rural countryside, and so they had to have a large antenna to pick up the Kansas City station. So everybody watched Channel 13. I mean, we had like a 70 rating. Three-quarters of the people with television sets would be watching the station in Topeka. Which would later become very important. 6:45 came along. The skies were darker, although we really couldn't see outside. But we began to get the ominous warning signs that we were in for a severe blow. And at 7 o'clock, we said, okay, let's go back on the air. I was without a coat, white shirt and tie, buttoned down like the style of the day. My wife and six-month-old baby were in married housing on the campus of Washburn. I had always told her that if anything serious really happened, I'd call her, but I was live. And I heard, we could hear the two-way around the corner in the newsroom all the way in the studio. And I heard that while I was on the air, the two-way cut in, and it was Ed Rutherford, who was a film cameraman, stationed as one of our spotters on Burnett's Mound at the southwest edge of the city. And he said, we've got a tornado on the ground. This broke kind of the glass veil of taking tornado warnings for granted and the attitude that it could never happen here. You become inured to, warning after warning, and you do kind of become calloused. And all of a sudden, we have a tornado on the ground, and it's on the southwest edge of the city, moving into the city, it can't quite be true. So I said to myself, and this is all within a flash, in between words, literally, as I gave a warning, but we're going to see, you know, what happens after Burnett's bound. I didn't say that, but in my own mind, I said, I want a confirmation. Burnett's Mound was a hill at the southwest edge of the city named for old Chief Burnett, who was a Potawatomi Indian chief, and the myth was that it was either an Indian burial ground or the little bump-up terrain that would cause a tornado to dissipate. And because they come from southwest to northeast, it would hit that and then go back up into the air and therefore protect the city. Well, as I was ad-libbing, filling, waiting for that second hit, it came when Ed called in and said, it's just wiped out, the Huntington apartment complex. Could have been the embassy complex in the decades since then, but nevertheless, I knew that it was a recently constructed 200-unit apartment building that we had covered. And if it wiped that out, it was a huge structure, and it meant that it was a very, very big tornado. I never saw the tornado, but those that did, you know, report what we would now judge to be an EF5, the worst you can get, and huge at the base, block wide, easily. And it was on the ground, and it was churning and causing problems, and I knew that this was it. It was headed for the Capitol building, and between the Capitol building and where it was the university, hospitals, residences, subdivisions, shopping malls, and people. I knew also that what I said in the next few seconds would mean life and death. You just know it. And it was a test for me, but I didn't know how serious I could be or exactly how to communicate. I thought about cussing, shock. I thought about crying because I felt an emotion welling up inside at the responsibility of that. And I blurted out a phrase, "For God's sake, take cover." And I think the serious demeanor communicated, I guess, pretty well, because at the end of the day, even though the tornado was on the ground for 12 to 20 miles, we lost only 18 people. That's terrible. But it wasn't the 150, 142 that they lost in Joplin. Why? We had a warning. And 75% of the people, you know, watching television were watching Channel 13. They saw the warning. We didn't have the sirens. We didn't have, you know, a lot of radio stations because the transmitters were blowing down, but they were able to get that message on television. And so that really sent most people to the basement. To this day, a long time after, people will come to tears when they see me, could be in Chicago, could be on the street, come to me and say I was there. Time for them and for me is measured by that moment. I was there. I was giving a speech in Emporia several years ago in a dedication of the pioneer woman, and it was 100 degrees in the middle of summer, and I came out and the bleachers were full. I said, after the speech, I said, "For God's sake, you know, what are you doing sitting out in the sun?" They said, "Well, we're from Emporia and Topeka and all the little towns, and we were watching that night when you said, 'For God's sake, take cover,' and gave the warning. And we stayed with you all night for 24 hours because we all have friends and we all knew someone in Topeka. And, you know, for many, you saved our lives." I don't think that has been repeated in my life, and I'm not sure that I know any other circumstance where it's been repeated for other broadcasters, but from that moment on, I decided broadcasting is for me, and God is saving the world from another lawyer. And I told the law firm in Wichita that I had accepted, where I accepted a job, that I wasn't coming, and sent out a tape, as is the practice, and within 3 months I was in Chicago, Illinois, at one of the biggest stations in the country, CBS, and I stayed with CBS for 30 years. But it was that experience that was formative, really, in my career, my attitude, my focus, because when the sky darkens, I naturally go to the warnings that are available and stick my finger in the air to make my own judgment on whether or not it's tornado weather. So it's it was quite an event. We simulcast for 24 hours on radio, and we reached 93 out of 105 counties, a huge radio station, one of the great stations of Kansas. And so people all around the state, it just, one reason it's made such an impression is that they were just bonded by listening to their, to the account on radio. And, you know, especially when we became sort of the center of communications, I said radio stations were off the air because their towers had blown down. WREN, that had Rick Douglas, a spotter, you know, taking cover under an overpass covered with mud in the pictures, you know, was off. And so we broadcast a call up for the National Guard, a call for emergency crews with chainsaws, ambulances that began flooding into the town because the phone lines were down after just a few minutes. And if they weren't down, they were jammed, so people couldn't get through. And so we began reading lists of names and families who were who had survived, and they wanted their relatives, you know, to know in these 93 counties that they're okay. We didn't know who was killed for, you know, several days, of course. The Forbes military came in and started helping. And there then began a series of predictable stages to a tornado disaster. The first stage is it came through, everything is gone, people are dead. The 8 out of 10 sandstone classroom buildings of Washburn are in rubble, and they will never be the same, and yet we're alive. And there is a feeling of euphoria in the carnival atmosphere. We're alive. And look at all the destruction around us. And then after a night's sleep and talking to neighbors, something else sets in, stage two. I'm alive, but I have nothing. What are we going to do? And that's when leadership has to get everybody together, sober up. We're going to rebuild, and we're going to look at the tools that are available to us. I don't know whether it was called FEMA at the time, but we did have trailers that were brought in to replace the law school. And, you know, the lawyers for years after would have to go to law school in the trailers and hand-carry the books from the library from building to building so they wouldn't be destroyed by humidity and moisture. For me, you know, it was the beginning of a career. I was blown out of town and 30 years, and I would go back for reunions, and I felt sorry for everybody who had to go to law school in those conditions. And then the third and the fourth were the reconstruction. You clear it away. Reconstruction begins. It's hard work, but, again, leadership and determination and the realization that your life will now be reconstructing what you had. Specifically, I mean, we had a hole torn out of the copper dome. We had buildings that had to be destroyed downtown. We had rail cars that were moved, and, of course, residential areas that were flattened and with only concrete slabs left. But the thing that everybody wanted to see was the university. It took 30 years before the trees reached a size that you could not see the path from Burnett's Mound, 12 or 22 miles through the entire city. 30 years. And I often think that the people who started reconstructing, if they had known it would take 30 years for all traces to be erased, would have done it. Now, 30 years, a new generation comes in. They hear stories of the tornado, and it's just a story to them, so they will go on, make new lives, and that's life renewing itself. But we all look back on that moment, and for those of us who were there is, you can call it a scar in your psyche and your amygdala, perhaps, post-traumatic stress disorder, whatever. It is a memory that is seared permanently, that we will never, never forget, and it changed our lives.
I'm visiting with veteran CBS broadcaster Bill Curtis, who was working at WIBW in Topeka during the 1966 tornado. Mr. Curtis, you were on the air 24 hours straight during and after the storm blew through Topeka. As someone who works in broadcasting, I gotta say, it's hard to imagine being on the air 24 hours straight. How did you do it?
Well, you have a lot of help. First of all, the newsroom was bonded there forever. But we had good reporters and people who had dedicated their lives, and even on the radio side. So you begin developing your stream of information. That's what we want, information. We didn't have instant pictures like they do today because it wasn't videotape. It was a Super 8 film camera, which means you had to process it and develop it. Still pictures, you know, eventually came from the newspaper. But for me, it was the source of information was phone. People, the newsroom, gathering some data, AP, the weather, National Weather Service, and people just walking in. Now, the studio is on the northwest side of the city, so you have to make a real effort. You have to drive out there. It's in the old, what would become the Menninger site for the entire hospital. It was an old Security Benefit Association life insurance campus. And I remember the first shock was when Newton Vickers, who was a judge in town, walked in and he said, I think I was on camera, and he said, "Well, Washburn's gone. Just gone." And here was a judge, and he carried the credibility of a judge. So it was a sobering moment, I think, for all of us, because it was the first time we had seen someone who was there. Then you have officials coming in, National Guard, who are using TV as the medium. And you become a traffic cop, testing information. But, you know, at the time, if you're an eyewitness to that, you really are not yet going to exaggerate by telling your friends. It's almost the pure form of truth, because your accuracy is limited to what you saw, but you saw it, and you're telling the truth. So we tried to do as many of those as we could. But, you know, the adrenaline is so high that you could go 24, you could go 48 hours. as a broadcaster, and you about midway through, you realize this is the biggest story of my life and will be. Did we do a good job? We put together a pamphlet after several months afterwards, a compilation of the letters that we received. And I still have it here on my desk. And the title of it was "For God's Sake, Take Cover." And the letters, I've never seen anything like it. You saved my life. We were watching Lost in Space on CBS when you came on. And, you know, your announcement caused us to go to the basement. We would have been killed if we had not been watching and watched you at that time. We just wanted to thank you. And we have thousands of letters. I don't know that that happens these days, because of a news event. But suddenly, we were a very important part of their lives. For WIBW, it has remained strong. It has remained the community station because they were there.
Mr. Curtis, you mentioned hearing that Washburn University was gone. And as you mentioned earlier, your wife and baby daughter were living in married student housing on campus. At what point did you get a chance to check in and make sure they were safe?
Well, I was kind of, as they say, holding the fire hose, and there was no one to hand it off to, so I couldn't go to a phone. I had told Helen that I would. And fortunately, there was some of the newsroom who came by and said, we got through to Helen, and she's okay. She's headed for the science building, which told me a lot. She was not going to go. Because I was going to call her. But a neighbor came by, and they had seen the broadcast. And they said, no, this is serious. He's on the air. Whether they explained that I couldn't call. And they all went up to the science building, the newest building on campus. And everybody in married housing or who was studying on campus at the time, they all crowded down. They felt the suction as the tornado went directly over as it pulled up through the elevator shaft. And when they came out, it was the end of the world because cars were jammed into the light wells leading into the basement. Cars were hanging in trees in the parking lot, and all the buildings were in piles of rubble like ancient Rome after some pillaging. Hanging from the trees were droplets of rain that were reflecting the sun, because as the storm front moves on, the sun is out in just this brilliant color without humidity that is just shocking. And so I was secure in the fact that even though I did not talk to Helen for hours, maybe the whole 24 hours, I can't remember being able to get through because you just couldn't get through on the telephone, but I knew that she was safe.
After your 24 hours on the air, what was it like to come out of the television station and see for yourself the devastation?
Well, it was shocking because even though we had been reporting on it, as I say, we never saw it yet, and everything we were reporting had been described to us, and you just are, breathless. My God, it's real. It wasn't just something that happened somewhere else. And you would confirm it. I remember I got out on a grassy lawn and would look down at the grass blades that were almost permanently blown flat in the direction the wind was blowing. That's how forceful it was. And then standing on a high point and watch the path lead up to the university and beyond. The whole thing was so shocking that the adrenaline carries you. It's a sort of a natural way to get through a moment of disaster, especially when you are a player in it.
Mr. Curtis, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Kay. It's always useful to go back over it again. And hopefully we'll pass on in oral history, what happened on June 8th, 1966.
That's veteran broadcaster Bill Curtis, who was on the air at WIBW for 24 hours straight the night of the 1966 Topeka tornado. Before that, we heard from Bonner Menninger, author of And Hell Followed With It. Again, if you have remembrances you'd like to share with us, visit KPR's Facebook page. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.